Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. Theresa May has been threatening opponents to her deal with no Brexit or a no deal Brexit. But Operation Prevent No Deal has begun in Parliament and MPs are trying to take no deal completely off the table. James, what are their plans?
So there's an amendment put down by a whole bunch of select committee chairs involving including Yvette Cooper, Nicky Morgan, Frank Field, who obviously voted for Brexit. And they are basically attempting to amend the finance bill so that the Treasury couldn't spend money on no deal unless Parliament had explicitly authorised it or voted for no deal. So the aim is essentially to make it very difficult for the government to do no deal. Now, the question is, how much does this attempt to prevent no deal ramp up? Because ultimately, there are two ways in which Parliament could prevent no deal from happening. One is to deny the government supply, to essentially say to make it impossible for the government to raise and collect taxes, and basically to essentially, as would happen in the run-up to the English Civil War, essentially force the government to shut down. The other option is to deny the government confidence, to essentially remove the government and hope to replace it with another government that would take no deal off the table. The complication in all this is Jeremy Corbyn and his own position. Because of the nature of the Corbyn fiscal programme and Corbyn's own ambiguity on Brexit, it's not obvious that removing this government would necessarily take no deal off the table and lead to what these people say that they want. But I think what we will see over the coming weeks is a kind of flexing of muscle by this body of opinion in Parliament that doesn't want no deal to try and take it off the table. Now, I think number 10's attitude to this is interesting because on the one hand, they don't want no deal to go off the table. But on the other hand, if they are to squeeze down the Brexiteer opposition to Theresa May's deal, it's quite helpful to them to be able to say, look, I know you guys think that if you vote this down, you'll get no deal. But look at this parliamentary majority against no deal. They won't let it happen. So I think one of the reasons why you won't see number 10 saying, oh, we're relaxed about this, we can see a way around it, is because one of the things that they need to happen to have any chance of passing their Brexit deal is for a large number of people who are currently opposed to the deal to think, hang on a second, if this deal doesn't happen, I won't get the no deal that I want, but I'm going to get either an even softer Brexit or I'm going to get no Brexit at all. So I think what you will see is number 10 saying that they are concerned about, you know, in private, number 10 are going to tell people that they are concerned about these amendments, that they have genuine force because it suits them. But I also think it is worth noting that ultimately, Parliament does have ways to stop no deal. Now, it is not simple, and it is quite dramatic. Obviously, the most dramatic of them is to simply unseat the government and then replace it with another government that wouldn't do no deal. But then I think the other is, you know, is are you prepared to threaten the basic operation of government to try and force Theresa May to back down? And I think one of the things that's happening with Brexit at the moment is that every camp in Parliament is thinking that the way to get what they want is to be the most unbending and the most uncompromising, and then things will fall into their lap. And that is, I think, it's whether that dynamic changes or not. That is one of the things that I think is making politics so uncertain and so unpredictable at the moment, is that everyone's view is that if they just stick fast to their position, they'll force other people to buckle and back down.
So, James, in short, will this amendment go through today, do you think?
I think we can't yet see I think it all depends on what Labour do. Logically, given that Labour rule out no deal, they should be prepared to back this, but, you know, it's unpredictable. But I think you will see attempts to prove that there is this parliamentary majority against no deal over the coming days and weeks.
Fraser, what do you think about this attempt at foiling no deal Brexit?
It's not a very good look, because what the MPs are saying is that we intend to basically sabotage the government. We intend to make things so difficult for the people of this country, not for politicians. The people who would suffer the effects if a Treasury wasn't allowed to spend on no deal are the people they're supposed to be representing. And you get into fairly difficult territory here. I mean, sure, Westminster is playing a very detailed political game right now, and the Prime Minister and Remainers want to take the option of no deal off the table, rather overlooking the fact that they all voted for it, not all of them, but there was a majority for it. Right now, no deal has Parliament's approval. They don't really have a mechanism of taking away that approval unless they vote for something else. Now, I think today's amendment is an expression of the frustration at their lack of options. Because sure, you can put down some sabotaging amendments. You can even put down a vote that would stop government being able to raise money at all. But instantly you start to then inflict far worse outcome on the British public than no deal itself. So if you're worried about the disruption the no deal might cause, how can you morally then vote to make that disruption a lot more worse through ways of frustrating the government? So I think you can hear Nicky Morgan on the radio this morning being quite embarrassed really about it, because this is a wrecking mechanism, is not what MPs are sent to Parliament to do. And you would argue, I would argue, that even at this late stage, the government's best chances of getting a better deal is to make the EU think that we would be prepared to go through with no deal because we have made the preparations. It doesn't fill us with terror. If it does fill you with terror, then there aren't going to be any more concessions from the EU, which I don't really think there will be anyway. But I am beginning to think that no deal is the least unlikely option, in which case I think Parliament has got a duty to make sure that as few lives are disrupted by this outcome as possible.
I think it all depends. Everything at the moment is where people think the blame will lie. Mm. So the group of select committee chairs backing this think that because no responsible government could carry on in the face of this parliamentary opposition, the government will have to back down. Now, obviously, as Fraser says, there's no guarantee that that would happen. In the same way that people on the no deal side think that if you ended up with disruption, which you almost certainly would, that you would be able to say, look, this disruption is because of the EU side choosing to make it. So I think this is one of the things that is not, which is not conducive to a compromise at the moment, is that everyone thinks that you can place the political blame somewhere else apart from them. And that is one of the things driving the current dynamic in politics.
And to distract us a little bit from Brexit today, Theresa May has announced her 10-year plan for the NHS. James, how is it looking?
I think there is a big question mark about the big challenge to the NHS is this. You know, is you basically have to start preventing. Because it is much cheaper to prevent people from getting sick than it is to cure them once they've got sick. If you look at the demographic change in this country, the ageing population, all right, that and all that, health inflation, the ever-increasing share of public spending that the NHS is taking up. Unless you can quite radically reduce the demand for the NHS will become, I think, an unsustainable burden, not now, not tomorrow, not in 10 years' time, but in 30, 40 years' time. It will just simply be too expensive to keep running. So I think there is this big challenge about how you prevent people from getting sick in the first place. I mean, that is a very difficult thing to do. And I think because government attempts at public health advice, sometimes they're effective, sometimes they are so draconian that people just strike them as unrealistic. But I mean, there is a big question mark about how to do that. I mean, there is also a big question mark about how to make the NHS better run. I think everyone knows from their personal experience that you go to some NHS hospitals and they appear to be from a totally different health system to another NHS hospital nearby, which has almost exactly the same level of funding. So the question is, how do you roll out best practice? How do you deal with the fact that the NHS is clearly not at the moment harnessing technology in the most effective way? And I think one of the fascinating things about the health secretary, Matt Hancock, is he's essentially a Treasury man running the Department of Health. And yet he's dressing up all the traditional Treasury talk of efficiency as, oh, I'm going to give you technology to empower patients. It's just a classic Treasury efficiency drive, but dressed up in much more patient-friendly language.
I mean, Simon Stevens is the head of the NHS and civil servant, but before he joined, he worked for Kaiser Permanente in California. Now, these American healthcare insurers are, ironically, far better than the NHS at encouraging people who are their members to take healthier steps to make it less likely that they're going to need healthcare. So if you join a gym, for example, you pay lower amounts in your health insurance. Now, Simon Stevens has always been struck by the idea that in Britain, given that the government runs a health service, it ought to be easier than anywhere else in the world to try to encourage people to take healthier steps to make sure they don't get sick in the first place. I mean, the government owns the GP clinics as well as the hospitals. The government owns the tax system. It should be able to create these incentives. But, of course, it's incredibly difficult because the NHS is one of the largest organisations in the world. As James was saying, it's a bureaucratic mess. So what is in theory possible and in practice possible are two very different things.
I mean, there's also a challenge, which is in an insurance-based system, you can adjust people's premium depending on how they live their life. In a single payer system, you can't charge someone more because they haven't done any exercise for the last 4 months. You know, that is one of the problems. And I think that, you know, and the problem is that when the state tries to do stuff, it, I think, appears excessively nannying. And I mean, there is also concern about what the, if you basically started offering people tax breaks for staying fit, people worry about what the distributional implications of that would be.
But Fraser, one of the biggest criticisms of the current government is that they don't have enough of a domestic agenda. Isn't this Theresa May showing that she does have something more up her sleeve than just messing up Brexit?
Yes, but her critics aren't really going to give her that allowance. I mean, let's take the front page of today's Guardian. It says NHS announces plans to save 500,000 lives. Nothing to do with the Tories. If something good is happening, it's happening because the NHS is doing it. So I don't really think there's going to be a way of getting credit.
I also think that in terms of domestic agenda, I mean, this is a decision to spend a bunch more money on the NHS. It's not actually the most kind of revolutionary thing ever to happen in British politics. But I think you're right that I thought it was very telling on the Mar show yesterday when he asked Theresa May if she was basically prepared to trade a sooner departure date to try and get her Brexit bill through, to essentially say to Tory MPs, don't worry, someone else will negotiate the trade deal. May made this reference to her domestic agenda, but she wanted to get Brexit through and do a domestic agenda, which is another sign that she really doesn't want to go anytime soon. And I think she, you know, she is not a Brexiteer. This is not what she wants to be remembered for, is some kind of domestic agenda. And I mean that she will be very loath to quit without that. I mean, this, you know, look, I think it is a forlorn hope, but what the government chooses to do on the first, you know, first day back in January of a year is normally their statement of intent about what their priority is. She's trying to say that her priority is the NHS and this, you know, this 10-year plan. But, you know, look, everyone is talking about Brexit. You know, it's not going to cut through in that way.
And everyone indeed is talking about Brexit. Tonight, James Graham's Channel 4 film Brexit, The Uncivil War is coming out at 9 o'clock. Fraser, you've seen it. Can you tell us what it's like without giving us any spoilers?
I think it's one of the best...
Leave wins.
I think it's one of the best political dramas that I've ever seen, actually. It doesn't purport to give accurate descriptions of the characters. Every MP comes across as an nincompoop. And the
How
general...
is that not accurate?
Oh, well, it depends on your point of view, of course. But what I think it really scores is it shows why Remain lost. And that was because the arguments had stopped resonating. They were having this mid-90s playbook, let's talk about jobs and the economy and we're going to win. And in fact, this wasn't working because the public, who are depicted in various ways in the documentary, were asking a different question. They were concerned about the way that globalisation was heading. They were concerned about what was happening to their community, their job security. And there were lots of reasons why the phrase take back control resonated with them. So that's why I love about this. I mean, sure, it does depict Westminster characters, but more to the point, this shows a seismic shift in our politics, which has happened not just in Britain, but in the continental Europe and in America as well. And it gives a real insight as to why that happened. I watched it with my wife at the weekend. Now, she finished it thinking this was incredibly pro-Brexit. There's a scene at the end where they get a forced confession out of Dominic Cummings, where he says, yes, of course, I'm as bad as the rest of them, and that Brexit's been a complete disaster. So you've got some bits at balance, but I don't think anybody who's a Brexiteer watching that film will feel it's been politicised. I think you're far more likely to get Remainers thinking, why haven't they been portrayed as the bunch of villains that they are?
I think one of the fascinating things about the Brexit referendum is, as Fraser said, how it showed a kind of playbook that didn't work anymore. But, you know, the classic, the Remain campaign was you know, some of the most talented operatives at that playbook, mm-hmm. and it just didn't work. I think one of the things that people didn't appreciate is how the crash changed everything. If you want to know why politics in the Western world is so uncertain at the moment, the crash is the event of our times. Because what that did was it cemented the death of deference. That, you know, I don't think people had in 2005 had any great love for the investment banks and all that, but they kind of reluctantly accepted that these bankers knew what they were talking about. And so when they said, do this, do that, people didn't like it, but they lumped it. But then after the crash, they basically thought these people didn't know what they were talking about anyway. And I always remember one of the most vivid memories of that campaign was that one of the senior people who'd gone to work on the Leave campaign had always explained it to me as an attempt to get close enough that you could either have another go in a few years' time and win, or that you would kind of get a Tory leader who was a Brexiteer, and then you would have a government committed to leaving the EU. One day this person texted me saying, turn the TV on, this is why I think we might actually win. And it was George Osborne and Jamie Dimon basically saying, if you vote to leave, there will be job losses, you know, the banks won't like it. And I think it was that sense that it gave people a chance to kick both a political class that they've fallen out of love with because of expenses and everything else, and an economic class that they've fallen out of love with because of a crash at the same time. And I think that was that impulse is one of the massive things that drove the Brexit vote and is driving uncertainty in our politics even now.
We'd normally wrap the podcast up at this point, but Cindy, I thought I'd turn the tables and ask you about something that you've written about. I mean, people have heard that China has got a probe on the dark side of the moon. Now, you've spent a few days reading the Chinese papers and watching the TV shows to find out, because we know how we see it in this country, is look what China's done, this shows how advanced they are. What do they mean by this? Is there something sinister towards this? Has the Chinese coverage been triumphalistic, jingoistic?
It's not been jingoistic. It's been very triumphal, as it rightly should be. I mean, this is an achievement that even NASA said was objectively impressive. So there's no reason not to be proud. But what I was surprised by when looking at the Chinese papers is how not smug it was. With a few exceptions, the majority of the papers were quite respectful. They were quite gracious about this victory. They said this was a victory for mankind, not for China, and not over the West or anything like that.
Not for the communist governments?
Yeah, no mention of communism whatsoever, no mention of a space race. They did say things like, now China is within the ranks of the big boys who can play in space exploration. I think that's fair enough. But I was quite surprised about how not smug everything was.
But you did find an article in the Global Times where they were looking at the New York Times' coverage and they were having a bit of fun at the tone of the New York Times, which it thought was basically American jingoism.
Yes, so the Global Times is the biggest tabloid in China. So as it stands, it's very hawkish and has a very colloquial way of writing. And it actually accused the New York Times of being blind. So the New York Times had said, you know, there was this media blackout before the launch just in case they failed. And isn't it funny that the Chinese don't even want to release this information beforehand? And the Global Times said, well, actually, we did have a live Twitter feed, but do you even understand Chinese? Are you, I mean, can you even read Chinese? So it's quite funny and got a lot of traction on Chinese social media, but it just shows that, you know, Chinese media is watching Western media, watching Chinese media.
Fraser and Cindy, thank you very much. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest from Westminster and beyond.